Hello, friends, and welcome to Conversations with Consequences. We are the radio show and podcast of the Catholic Association, where we aim to change the culture one conversation at a time. You can listen to Conversations with Consequences on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network, Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. Eastern, or catch the encore at 5 p.m. We are also on Sirius XM channel 130. Of course, our radio show is also a podcast. Go to thecatholicassociation.org or directly to wherever you listen to your podcast. Welcome to the show, Conversations with Consequences. I'm your hostess, Ashley McGuire, and I'm joined today by my wonderful colleague, Betsy Fentress. And we also have a very exciting guest on today, and it's perfect timing because we find ourselves here in this final stretch of Advent, looking ahead to Christmas. And who isn't hungry for content, entertainment that uplifts and inspires us as we gather with our families? And one person who takes this very seriously is Tim Reckert. He is a Catholic father of three who is also an Oscar-nominated writer, director, and animator. And he's currently the chief creative officer of Sycamore Studios. And some of you, in fact, most of you, are probably familiar with his most famous work, which is the Christmas classic, The Star, which is an animated Christmas movie that came out in 2017. It's an annual tradition in my house. I've probably seen it more than two dozen times. And who doesn't love The Star? And so we're so blessed to have with us today, Tim Reckert. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. I'm excited for this conversation because I am feeling the Christmas spirit. Yeah, so let's dive in.
So Tim, there's so many different ways to be in the entertainment industry. And for someone like me who's out in DC and is mostly in politics, it's kind of a foreign world. But you have found yourself primarily in animated content that really caters to children. Tell us how you wound up in that sphere.
I always wanted to make movies, never really thought much about animation, but I discovered as an undergrad I took an animation class kind of on a lark just to see what it would be like. And I found that I really liked it. And I was achieving good results in my animation, and everyone else in the class was miserable and achieving pretty bad results. And so I was like, huh, I have like some kind of weird advantage in this space. So maybe this is like a weird subset of the film industry where I could have like an accelerated, you know, just career trajectory. So then I went to grad school to study animation specifically. And then, so that's like how I found myself doing it. It was a bit of a surprise. But the why I'm sticking around and why I love it so much is that there is a certain mode that the viewer, I feel like when you watch an animated movie, you take on this attitude of openness and innocence and just being ready to kind of receive the story. And there's just something that where you get to meet people on much more friendly ground than with a lot of live action film where people are coming skeptical and just sort of like, yeah, impress me. Like with an animated film, there's this feeling of I'm here to just delight you. And I hope that's what you came to see the movie for. And that's usually the attitude people come with the movie. So I think it kind of invites the filmmakers and the people watching the films to just have a little bit more fun and be ready to, okay, so this is a movie about all the little characters living inside your head, or this is a movie about the toys in your room, they come to life. Just go with it, because we've got a really fun story to tell you if you can kind of go this far with us, you know? So I like having that relationship with the audience.
Speaking of the people that you got to meet, there's a star-studded cast of voices in that movie, from Oprah Winfrey to Kris Kristofferson to Mariah Carey. I mean, how in the world, Patricia Heaton, how did you get all of those people together for this? It's Walden Films, where that's the company, right? That you were.
Yeah, it was a co-production with Walden. Co-production. And Sony Pictures Animation was really kind of the cornerstone company doing it. And so Sony Pictures Animation is now very well known for the Into the Spider-Verse, like animated Spider-Man movies, but those hadn't come out yet. So prior to that, kind of their best known properties were Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs and Hotel Transylvania. And so just a kind of very comedy flavored studio, which is a lot of fun. Obviously with this one, we wanted to do something that was certainly had like a comedic spin on it, but we wanted to see if we could deliver something that was very deep and meaningful as well. Something that kind of rose to the occasion of the nativity story. The casting, funny thing is that in animation, casting is one of the easiest nuts to crack, because the job of doing an animated voice is, I think, probably the easiest job any actor actor has ever had. You just show up. I mean, it's a lot like what we're doing right now. You show up in front of a mic. You can be wearing your pajamas. I noticed that none of us are, but you could be, right? No one would ever know. And you don't have to memorize any lines. The script is on a music stand right in front of you, and you just kind of run the lines a few at a time. And you know, you get to play around. You get to try it in a different voice. You know, it's just a lot of fun, low pressure. And so it turns out that asking someone to be in an animated film is very different from asking them to like come to Romania with us for 3 weeks while we shoot this, you know, piece of the horror film or, you know, whatever it is. It's like, that's a much bigger ask. So with a lot of these people, it was just, you know, a connection that someone happened to have. So like Oprah and Tyler Perry were both, I think, personal friends of my executive producer, Devon Franklin. He literally sent a text and was like, we're doing this, you know, we'd love to have you in. Would you like to? And they were like, yeah, let's do it. Another thing that's funny is like, okay, so Ving Rhames is in the movie. He's the voice of Thaddeus, the scary of the two bad dogs, the scary one.
Right.
Great voice. He's got this just low, low basso profundo. And he actually does the voice also of the Arby's commercials. We got the meats, you know, so that's the guy we're working with. And Ving's whole thing is that like, as a live action actor, he tends to play like scary gangster guys. He's just a physically large guy. And so he kind of has this imposing, intimidating presence. As a result, I don't know how old his children are, maybe nieces and nephews, but I know he mentioned there were young people in his life that could never actually go see the movies that he's in. And so this kind of thing can be an opportunity a lot of times for actors to be in a movie that like my kids could actually watch.
Right.
So yeah, a lot of reasons people come to the movie.
Well, it's been one of my kids' favorite for as long as, I mean, since the movie came out. And so I have a, well, two-part question. One, and for our listeners, it's the story told, it's the nativity story, if you haven't seen the movie, told through the point of view of the animals. It really actually made me reflect on the fact that the animals are an important part of the nativity. Like, why would God choose to come into the world surrounded by animals? And so first question is, you know, what made you come up with this idea? Was this something that you had been thinking about since you were a kid? And then secondly, I think everybody's got their favorite animal. Mine is Dave. I love Dave the bird. So do you have a favorite animal in the star?
Great question. Okay, let me answer the second question first, because I have sort of a funny way of answering it, which is that I've eaten almost every animal in the star, because I actually did have donkey in Italy one time. And I've yet to have camel or mouse, but I think I've hit all the other bases. I had horse carpaccio in Canada, which I don't know what they're doing up there, but they do serve that. So anyway, I could give you my favorite from that standpoint, which would probably be Edith the cow. But I know that's not the question you're asking. I think I have to say Felix, the funny camel, which is Tracy Morgan. He's so quotable. And so much of what's in the movie is just him ad-libbing. And it was like, that's great. That was not what we wrote. But, you know, and the funny thing was when we designed the character, we thought, okay, this is the goofy camel. He'll be funny. He's funny. So he's got a big smile in the character designs. And then when we recorded Tracy like almost never smiles. He's always like angry with this like stiff upper lip and like suspicious and paranoid. And it was like, oh my gosh, that's actually Felix. Forget the big smile. He's got to be like always with this kind of consternated expression on his face. Oh guys, I'm dying back here, you know? So it's really cool to see how his performance just totally shaped the character. And I find him so watchable in the movie. But so then as far as like where the movie came from, it's kind of a funny one. Like, a lot of times the movies that you see are pitched by the director or the writer or something to the studio. This case was not like that. This actually was a script that had been written in 1997, I think, right after the movie Babe came out. If you remember Babe, the talking pig, and it was, you know, a wonderful
movie. Love that movie.
Yeah, it's a great movie. And the Henson Company developed... That's right. So there's Walden, Sony Pictures Animation, and then the Henson Company as well was the third company on the project. And really the movie originated with them, and they developed the star originally as a live action film that where they would be using kind of the Babe technology to make the animals. That plus, you know, some great Henson puppeteering and everything to make the animals talk and do it that way. But the movie just kind of never got off the ground, and it just sat on the shelf for almost 20 years. I mean, yeah, the crazy thing is I was like 10 years old-ish when that script was first written. And then here I was, you know, in the 20 teens, finally directing this thing. And so we kind of had to redevelop it for animation. Some of the audience taste and the way that children's and family entertainment has evolved and really in the time since Pixar, because when you think about 1997, the only Pixar movie that had really come out was Toy Story. We hadn't like realized what family entertainment could be at that time.
Right.
So we tried to redevelop it to make it more sophisticated and really speak to both kids and parents and make it satisfying for everybody. And so I came in as someone that they knew was Catholic and they knew I was Christian. They wanted to have a filmmaker on it who would be able to tell the story authentically, like from a place of belief. And I came in, yeah, just kind of like insisting, like, if we're going to do this, I don't want to do a faith-based movie. I never got into filmmaking to do a faith-based movie. And I hate that term because it makes it feel like the movie's based on faith, but the movie's got to be story and character based. And maybe the audience's interest might be faith-based, but if we're going to give them something satisfying, it's going to have to be a good story with appealing characters who go on a journey and change. You know, all those, it's like the same application of craft. But at the same time, when you do have a sacred subject, there is a real opportunity to dig deep. And I will say, you didn't ask me this, Ashley, but you touched on something I'd love to talk about, which is this really afforded me a rare opportunity to like spend a year during our development, just like diving deep into what really are the themes of the Christmas story? Because, you know, in the story of Jesus writ large, this is chapter one. Like you don't, in some ways, you don't really get the payoff. Like, and if the birth of Jesus feels grand, then you're kind of betraying the subject matter, because the whole point is that it wasn't grand. It was very humble. And, you know, one of the things that also occurred to me, Ashley, was like, this is not just Jesus. Like, Jesus could have been born literally in the gutter or in the sewers or in a pile of dirt. It's not just like, I think we tend to think of like, he's born in a stable. It's the lowest thing. It's not the lowest thing, actually, but it's a very specific thing. And what it is it's surrounded by animal life. And in a, you know, okay, the manger, of course, is not my observation. I think the fathers of the church have pointed this out, that he's born in the place where the animals eat from. It's like, this is he's going to be the bread of life. Mm. They lay him in the manger, and manger is from manger in French, to eat, right? So, but yeah, the other kind of insight that I had thinking about this, and by the way, this movie, we were developing it right after Pope Francis published Laudato Si, his encyclical letter about, you know, man's relationship to nature. And so I was taking a lot of notes from that and trying to figure out, like, what do we learn about man's relationship to animals through this movie? And there are a lot of little bits in there. Like, for instance, Bo does not have a name until Mary names him. And I mm-hmm. thought, like, there's something there about Adam and Eve. And, you know, like, we can treat animals as machines. We don't need, you know, we don't have to name a donkey if it's just going around in circles. But once you decide to have a relationship with this animal, you kind of ennoble it and bring it a little bit more into a human sort of place where, like, now Bo has a name because someone decided to love him. And yeah, another thing was that we tend to do, like, in the Christmas pageant, that the last innkeeper says, oh, I've got no room, but you know what I do have is I've got a stable back here and you can come stay there, mm-hmm. which is totally fine. I mean, and maybe probably the way it happened, but it's not from the standpoint of making this movie where it was about the animals. That's not in the Bible, so it could equally have been. And the choice we decided to make was, this is the animals inviting Mary and Joseph into their space. And so we have that moment where the three stable animals are kind of like sweeping the floor and making it nice as it can be, because it's their space. And so really it's the animals who get the privilege in the Christmas story of hosting their creator. It's a beautiful thing. And the other thing that kind of blew my mind is, and maybe this, I wonder if I'll be able to phrase this in a way that captures what blew my mind about this. Jesus Christ is the creator, you know, God is the creator of everything. God created us human beings. And we tend to think, okay, so then therefore God, to show his love to us, became one of us. Fine. Yes, he did. But God also created chickens and rats and camels, and he didn't come to them as a chicken or an animal or a rat. And yes, they didn't experience the fall, so maybe they didn't need it. But what's interesting to me is that God loves all his creation. He called all his creation good, but he chooses to come touch that creation physically with human hands, which I think kind of feels like an mm-hmm. elevation of the stewardship that we are given in the book of Genesis. It's like, yes, take care of these things. But now that role has just been upgraded, because it's not just like, be a steward and take care of the garden. It's like God himself touched chickens and animals and sheep and goats with human hands. So when we touch animals and when we interact with animals, we're really standing in the stead of God, their creator, who came as one of us to love them as well. Doesn't love them the same way he loves us, but I still think, anytime Jesus caressed a cat or something like that, that was God, loving his creation. And I think it kind of ennobles the calling that we as human beings have to love animals and plants too.
That is really helpful in understanding sort of how you got into this. I wanted to just follow up a little bit about what you said about not wanting to do a faith-based movie. And, Flannery O'Connor writes about this in her book, Mystery and Manners. And anybody who's in the creative arts is, am I a Catholic artist or am I an artist who's Catholic? So you ended up with another kind of blockbuster thing that you did, which was the Hallow Apps commercial for the Super Bowl. So, are you getting a name for yourself a little bit as somebody who's not afraid to tackle this subject matter? And what's it like to be a Christian in Hollywood?
Yeah, so Betsy, what you're talking about for the audience, in case they hadn't seen it, is that this past Super Bowl 2024, I directed the Hallow commercial with Mark Wahlberg and Jonathan Rumi making an appearance, and where it was, sort of them praying in a church. That was really fun and amazingly came at a moment when I was, I've been working on building this studio. Anytime you're kind of in the early stages of building a company, there's also kind of a cash flow issue because you're not making money from the company you're starting. So I prayed a novena for work and got a cold email from Hallow on day 7 of that novena, and it led to like a really needed sort of infusion of cash and a really fun job as well. But and I bring that up to say that in a way, the career that I have is not the career that I would have designed for myself when I was 22 years old. I thought I would be making, I don't know, just regular old secular movies. And I have, it's not in a way for lack of trying, but the doors that God has chosen to open for me have been these things. And it looking back at my career, I sort of, I think looking ahead from that perspective of the 22-year-old, I assumed that being Catholic would be a drag on my career advancement. But the way it's turned out, it seems like the things that have worked out best have been because of my faith. So that's the star, and that's the Hallow commercial, and wonderful opportunities like that. I was on a project totally secular at Netflix for 2.5 years that unfortunately ended up getting canceled. And that was, I thought, my moment to break out of like being in the faith-based box, but the movie didn't get made. So, I guess I find myself here, I think, because God has decided to put his signature on my career and make sure that I know that it's not something I built on my own, that this was a gift that he gave me, and that's important for me to know, so that I'm always aware that I'm the servant with the talents, and eventually the master is going to come back and ask me to hand them over to him, and I need to be ready to do that.
So, Tim, I have a question that's kind of a play on that, but more asking you to put on your dad hat, your Catholic dad hat. And, as parents today, trying to navigate the entertainment industry is tricky. And, unfortunately, things that used to be kind of, safe spaces, if you will, for entertainment for kids are not. And, I find myself having to do all kinds of scrutinizing and research before I can even let my kid watch the latest sequel of, you name it. So I don't know, what are your thoughts on how the industry has evolved regarding children, and how do what are some of your favorites, your recommendations, your series, your movies that, you think are great for your kids? Or, your answer may be what many people are doing, which is saying we got rid of our TV, and you hear like Steve Jobs didn't even let his kids have phones. So how do you navigate all that as a Catholic dad?
Yeah, it's a great question. Very much on my mind, and that's really a big reason that my partner and I started Sycamore Studios, was that we felt like there is a real need for some kind of trustworthy alternative, and therefore also a real market opportunity as well. So Sycamore Studios, the way that we've put our we're not a faith-based company, but the way that we put the type of entertainment we want to make available to parents is that we want to make entertainment so good you don't want to leave the room, but so good that you can, because a lot of times it feels like you can't. A lot of times it feels like you got to kind of be like sort of in kind of an athletic position, ready to pounce on the TV as soon as something, goes across that you don't want your kids to be seeing. And so our goal with Sycamore Studios is to make trustworthy content, trustworthy entertainment for that families can love, and not just stuff you can trust because it's innocuous and safe, but stuff that truly elevates and inspires and edifies families from a standpoint of, like, having a positive vision of, and by positive, I just mean like having an actual belief in like what it means to be human and what a good life looks like and what it means to grow up into a virtuous man or woman. So, which is to say that we want to offer things that actually help parents parent. Because that's what we want as fathers. So now that being said, it makes me sad when I hear that parents, because I know parents who have too, just like decided, ah, screw it, we're out of the movie and TV business. And now, first of all, I don't think it makes sense because everything that, not to like sound like an old man and think about when I was your age, but everything we grew up on, which I think we feel pretty okay about. Maybe we shouldn't, I don't know, but at least I do. That stuff's still available. So, my kids love all the old 90s Disney movies, and why not? I got into my career, I found my vocation because I loved watching movies as a kid. And so, we're even in my own household, I think my wife would be fine, like, not really doing screen time, but I instituted a policy of Saturday morning cartoons. It's not a TV block anymore, but we just, that Saturday morning is designated like screen time, and the kids can choose which movie they, and of course I'm curating the selection, but they can choose which, not to like say the quiet part out loud, but which of my favorite movies they get to watch, so I think we don't need to be afraid, certainly, of that. But then also, it's like the wrong version of the Benedict option. It's the retreat. And it's like, why should we be retreating? We should be fixing this. We should be playing offense, not continually drawing the line back and just playing a policy of victory through defense, which will never happen. I think we need to not only be engaged as consumers, but also like be engaged enough that our demand moves the needle for those producing content. And truth be told, it's happening already. Like, you're seeing a company like Disney, which I would say probably is like the protagonist of this kind of shift that you were describing, Ashley. Like, a lot of those Disney movies started to have just content that parents were like, "Is this really for kids? Is this what you want my kids to be watching?" We're starting to see, and I literally just read a headline an hour ago about an example like this, where Disney's deciding, like, some of this stuff we're going to leave to the parents to decide, and we're going to leave it out of our entertainment, which is good. That's, that is what I think, that's what the demand, that's what parental demand can do. It can actually kind of change the landscape of the offering. And yeah, so I would encourage parents to not give up hope. At worst, just rely on your favorite movies, and at best, like, yeah, get really engaged, because I think there is an opportunity in the years ahead, if we're engaged, to push the marketplace in our direction.
So what's in the pipeline for you? I wanted to also make a shout out that you were involved with Tumbleleaf, which I love watching with my grandkids.
Yeah, Tumbleleaf's actually, to your question, Ashley, Tumbleleaf's a good preschool show that I think I can wholeheartedly endorse. It's a preschool show, stop motion. I love stop motion. I was an animator on that show, and it is like, as opposed to something like Cocomelon, which is like cutting every second and a half, and just, it's, as many people have said, it's like crack cocaine for children. Tumbleleaf has this gentle, just more kind of ambling, relaxed kind of tone to it, and it's very pastoral. It almost all of it is set outdoors in this kind of interesting, sort of dilapidated landscape where the, anyway, it's a great little show. So yeah, Tumbleleaf is great. We love Bluey, but I'm not saying anything new there. Everyone knows Bluey is awesome, and me, my partner, my business partner Christian, my wife Hannah, all of us, my sister, we adults watch that show, and a tear comes to our eye. So yeah, that's a great show. If people aren't watching Bluey, oh, come on, get on the bandwagon already. What was your question, Betsy?
What's down the pipeline for
Oh
you and
yeah.
Sycamore Studios?
Right, so Sycamore, our main focus is on theatrical features. So a lot of people are kind of proclaiming the death of the theater, but we think the theater is a really great arena for competition. One way to put it is like, hey, we're entering a space that has been dominated for the last 100 years by Disney, and we, as a startup, hey, at some level, can't compete with their marketing budget and their muscle, but they can't program every 52 weekends of the year. And that infrastructure is still there every weekend, and it needs content, it needs inventory. And so to us, this is a great arena for us to like enter and find a way to define ourselves in the mind of our audience. So the theatrical features that we're starting with, we've got our first one is a Dr. Doolittle feature. Again, it's not a faith-based property, but we believe Dr. Doolittle is a great place. It's a great character, you know, sort of it's a definite childhood wish fulfillment to be able to talk to animals. So already we're capturing something really beautiful there. But it's also just, you know, telling the story of Dr. Doolittle, his relationship to animals. It's a great place to start having a conversation about, in our case, it's about loyalty, virtue and friendship, you know, integrity, doing things not just because people are watching, but because it's the right thing to do. So yeah, Dr. Doolittle is our first movie. Our second movie that we've announced is based on a really cool graphic novel called Zeta the Space Girl. It's written by a graduate of Christendom College. He opens the first book with a G.K. Chesterton quote. So we're very much in kind of Catholic imagination world with these books. But it's
nice.
One way to put it is it's like Star Wars if Jim Henson made Star Wars in the 1980s. So it's got a real sense of humor and a wackiness to it. Really fun world. We've got a third movie that we're closed on deal terms, but we have not yet announced it. But it's, again, based on a really huge graphic novel that we love. And it's going to be a really fun project. So you can see, like, the movies we're doing, they're not on a sacred subject, but we think that they really give us a really kind of solid material to work with to build something that is that totally aligns and supports the types of things that parents are looking for.
Well, Tim, we sadly are out of time. I could talk about this for hours, and we're so grateful for your time with us today and for all that you're doing. You're so right that we're not called to retreat. We're called to engage, and entertainment is such a big part of our culture, and we can't abandon it. So thank you for everything that you're doing, and I've added Tumbleleaf to my list. I call it the list of approved shows, so I'm taking your word for it. So thank you, Tim. Thank you, Betsy. Thank you both for joining us today.
This was great. Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences. I'm Lee Sneed.
And I'm Betsy Fentress.
And we are in the midst of the beautiful Christmas season. Don't you just love this time of year, Betsy? Of course, now that the work is done, it's easier to enjoy it. It's time to really kick off that octave of Christmas.
I'm very excited. We have a house full of people, and my grandkids are coming, and
so
my
nice.
Kids come from far away. And yeah, it's going to be a beautiful, several days, right up till New Year's Day.
Fantastic.
Lee, you were recently featured in a National Catholic Register article on tapping into the wonder of Advent. So now that it's over, I wanted to check in on how it went. Here's what you wrote. For us, Advent means we'll build gingerbread houses on the Feast of St. Nicholas, have a family outing to pick out a tree, and decorate the lights for the Feast of St. Lucia, eat seven types of fish and seafood on Christmas Eve, while we finally adorn the tree with garlands and ornaments. And you talk about throughout the season encouraging your kids to secretly do nice things for one another and to give up indulgences and little treats, except for the tiny chocolates in their Advent calendars. And you lit the wreath each night after dinner. You also wrote that this year we've decided to kick off our Advent with a modified technology fast of no video games for your children and no mindless scrolling for you. Your Advent rhythm is now as much a part of your family traditions as the stockings embroidered with names that grace your mantle each year. So let me ask you, you had all these intentional observations of the season of waiting for the birth of our Lord. How did it go?
Well, yes, this is the time to reflect on that. You know, I like the word rhythm there. I'm glad I used that word because it's definitely allows for some wiggle room. Not everything went according exactly on every feast day. Things got bumped a little bit. The lighting of the tree got bumped one day. We did ninja bread men instead of gingerbread houses, which was still really fun for St. Nicholas. The lights took a little longer. We had to go back to Lowe's, you know, typical messy family Christmases. But, you know, still, I do like having anchors because it's not just the end of the liturgical year. It's like the end of the fiscal year, I guess, or the calendar year. And there's all
Right.
that kind of stuff. There's meetings that have to be done, finances that needed to be settled, just all that kind of like minutiae of life. And that can interfere with it. But when you have these saint days popping up on your calendar, you can at least, maybe I don't do all five of the things I plan on doing for each of those days, but you can do one. You can, I think we went out to eat Mexican food on the Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe. And just little, just can just do a little thing to mark it in the calendar, mark it in the minds and the memories of your kids, I think. And that's what I strive to do. I really do set off with big goals every year, but here we are, and now it's just time to let it go and give in to Christmas.
Do you feel like your kids really felt that anticipation building as you moved toward Christmas?
I do, especially when we tell them sort of ahead of time this is coming, and remind them, because it's easy to sort of forget. Maybe you watch a new Christmas movie and you see that tradition and you're like, ooh, let's do that. It's like, no, this is the way we do things, guys. I'm like, oh yeah. And they look forward to getting, the same things out. We've had the same Advent wreath that we bought from a Boy Scout troop, the first Christmas we lived in Indiana at our parish, and I've seen so many, pretty ones, upgraded ones, but we just stick to this one. This is the one that comes out of the basement every year, and it's what everybody's used to seeing on the table. And so I do think doing these same things, at least some of the same things every year, and marking it, and we've some really great feasts during Advent. So
There really are. My daughter sent me a picture of this beautiful kind of a challah bread braid that they made for Saint Lucy,
yeah,
and
that's
the little
great.
raisins to
Yeah.
have, to stand in for her eyes, which is a
I know. It's always, well, since my boys have gotten older, they appreciate that part of the story a little more. They think it's pretty fun. Yeah, I think that, yeah, there's so many like Italian traditions for St. Lucie and Scandinavian traditions. And well, in my part of the world, you too, I think, have got a lot of snow already this year. The Scandinavian traditions just seem to fit, with cinnamon rolls is what we do usually on the morning. And yeah, I mean, it's really great, but I am glad to be here at the on the other side.
I'm glad that you brought up, you called it the fiscal year, but one of the things that my husband and I really love to do is to sit down at the at this time of year and write checks to really meaningful charities and people that are in need. And we started doing this, I don't know how many years ago, but we sit together and one person writes the check and the other one puts it in the mail, or we do it online. Last year, we actually did it from South Bend, where we were visiting family, and did it from our computer. But it's a great way to end the year, and this is a season to remember people who really need our support.
Absolutely. And how do you decide? Do you often go back to the same charities, or do you try to do new ones every year?
We do locally. We usually are involved in Missionaries of Charity, and that's in person. Sometimes they'll have pizza parties for kids, or they need cupcakes or hams or whatever. So I just call and see what the sisters need. But we love the St. Vincent de Paul Society and some other local people, and always pro-life organizations.
Us
Just
too.
something about giving at this time of year to organizations that are involved with babies. It just feels
Yeah, it
right.
just feels right. That's funny because we, as like an extended family, have just several years ago, once there were a number of grandkids, we finally just said to, our parents and our siblings, let's just all as families choose charitable organizations to give that money to, rather than buy each other things that we don't necessarily need. We'll buy the fun stuff for the kids. Everyone can give their nephews, grandsons presents, but the adults we do. And sometimes, it's all one big lump thing, or sometimes it's just part of what we do, or sometimes it's thinking it's what a family member might like, but it might not be. But it's a really nice way, I think, to use that sort of Christmas spirit. When you think, about helping other people, it's so easy to focus on the commercial stuff and what your kids need and new winter coats and things like that.
You're the second person that said this to me in the last week,
Oh,
that
wow.
as your family grows and the adult children don't really need anything, that there's maybe a token thing that, certain brothers or sisters might give, but that it's time to focus on the children and to those in need. So I love that.
Well, Betsy, you recently wrote a piece for our Substack, which you should all read, calling on Saint, our new doctor of the church, Dr. John Henry Newman. So tell me about that piece and talk about your Advent sort of practice this year.
Yeah, so I've just kind of latched on to the word doctor, related to Cardinal John Henry Newman, and I just kept thinking
Thank you.
about
I got my words jumbled. Sorry, Bets.
what that meant, and I just love the fact that there's this new doctor, and you and I have both been on pilgrimages to England related to martyrs and important people in the Catholic Church, and so I had the opportunity to go to Littlemore, and
Me
be
too.
in the you too in the little chapel. And so he just has really captured a place in my heart. So what I wrote, I was kind of doing a little riff on words. I wrote a piece called This Advent Follow Newman's Prescription for Perfection. And it's from a short essay, which is a little page and a half that he wrote called The Short Road to Perfection. And I picked that because I like having a plan for Advent, and I realized that especially at this time of year, it's the beginning of our liturgical year. So even though it's not our calendar new year, it's a time to start new practices and start fresh. And so I really feel like I have benefited from that.
And you say you even keep it on your night table and your desk,
I have it right in front of me.
and
Yeah.
that really helps you find?
It does. It
Yeah.
does.
And is it something that you've shared with other members of your family?
My husband slash editor read it and was very sweet, but no, I haven't. I just put it on our Substack.
That's wonderful. And is it something that you think you'll continue to do, or do you
I
think you'll,
do, I do,
I think
and
it's probably good all year round, right?
yes.
If you ask me what you are to do in order to be perfect, I say, first, do not lie in bed beyond the due time of rising. Give your first thoughts to God. Make a good visit to the Blessed Sacrament. Say the Angelus devoutly. Eat and drink to God's glory. Say the Rosary well. Be recollected. Keep out bad thoughts. Make your evening meditation well. Examine yourself daily. Go to bed in good time, and you are already perfect.
It really sounds simple, Lee, but it's just the habit of doing the same thing every day. And these are all devotions, some of which have already been part of my life. But I have found getting up in the morning, I just kind of get right to it with the Angelus. And during the day, kind of stopping, and at the end of the day, being thoughtful in my examine. And I have to say that, I found a book in my house that I had given to my husband, and it's our resident chaplain, Roger Landry's Plan of Life, Habits to Help You Grow Closer to God.
I was just going to bring up that book.
And it's the same thing, but really fleshed out. And it's not the same thing, but it has a lot of the same moments. Like, for instance, the beginning is the heroic moment, don't hit that snooze button. And
Yes.
in the winter, it's hard to do that. So,
It really is. In fact, I thought of that book when I was reading your Substack piece. It's exactly like that because my one little thing that I do every day from that book is I have a tiny crucifix on my nightstand and I roll straight to the floor and I offer my day to our Lord. And I feel like all I say is to myself, just at least do that. But if when I do that, which is most days, unless I've been woken up by some kind of child crisis, I do more. If I do that, I do more. So amazing.
So anyway, I hope to continue that into the new year. So, Lee, what are some favorite traditions that your family does between Christmas and New Year's?
Well, we definitely do a lot of lounging and eating, especially on the 26th. We usually have some leftover roast, which usually it's like one day of a repeat meal of Christmas Day, and then steak sandwiches, which my eldest is always really He's a hungry boy, so he's always excited about the steak sandwiches. We do celebrate often the 12 days of Christmas. So we try to do something special together as a family. Sometimes a lot of times this is actually just done on a whim. Even though I intend to celebrate the 12 days of Christmas, sometimes I'll hold back things that I had bought for Christmas Day, and because sometimes it's overwhelming, or gifts from grandma can come, on the 28th, and we can just sort of pace things out, which works for our family, and plus it makes it fun. And I think leading up to Epiphany, it makes the waiting of Advent. You understand the contrast between the not Christmas and Christmas.
It's shocking to me that people take down their trees before Epiphany. It just doesn't feel
Oh, I
right.
know.
And that's one of the things that we're pretty adamant about. And it often goes well into January because you've done all this work and you really want to enjoy the whole season. And so we keep everything up. We keep the nativities and the
We do too.
tree and the outdoor lights. And but some of the fun things that we like to do is we're sort of tournament oriented. So we'll have a Scrabble tournament.
Oh,
We'll
that's
do
fun.
Trivial Pursuit, and our grandkids will play bingo and Pokino, which is this game that you have a board and has playing cards on it, and you get chips, and it's just really fun. But Scrabble is a big one. We have some literary people in our house who like words. I don't have the patience after a couple of rounds.
Do you play on teams?
Sometimes we do, yeah, sometimes we do, and I'll go to bed before it gets too late, but because we've got some night owls here. But we have somebody who plays the piano in our house, and so we always sing lots of songs on
Oh,
Christmas
that's so
Eve.
nice.
And I like to make a nice bordelaise sauce on Christmas day night. And it's just a time because we don't all live in the same city to really slow down and to savor one another and to enjoy. It's funny, we don't leave our house that much. Usually it's cold, and we're not going to the mall for the big discounts. We just want to be able to not be on the phone and be in person with each other.
Yes, all that. That's wonderful. And do you have any specific Christmas Eve or Christmas morning, cocktails or muffins or prayers or practices or traditions as things that everyone looks forward to, that the kids when they get back together with their siblings and you all like think like, yes, this is our family Christmas.
We have some very dear friends that live, there's one house in between us, and we always go there. And it's so festive. And they have this beautiful spread. And so our kids really, really love that. And we look forward to it every year. And then Christmas morning, I like to bake. So I usually mix up cinnamon rolls the night before and have a nice Christmas brunch. And then when I was growing up, we had a rule that you were not allowed to open the presents until you'd been to Mass. So we don't usually open. I know a lot of people do that Christmas Eve, but I like to do it Christmas Day. I like to, have celebrated on Christmas Eve and been at Mass on Christmas Day. And we have a beautiful basilica here in St. Louis. And
Yeah, I've been there. It's so beautiful.
recently, we've gone to midnight Mass, and it's kind of fun to leave the Christmas Eve party and just to get in the spirit. And it is packed to the gills. It looks like the United Nations. There are people there from all over the world.
Amazing.
And it's just really, really a gorgeous, beautiful, beautiful mass.
Wow, that's really great. I would love to hit a midnight mass someday, but it's not my
I
season.
know I couldn't do it either for a while.
How early do you have to get to that midnight
Well,
mass?
there's a choir that starts at 11:30, so you got to get
Wonderful.
there. Yeah, you got to get if you want to have a seat, you
Have a
better get.
seat,
Yes, right.
I think our church has two overflow areas.
Nice.
But it's we go in the morning. It works better with our family's rhythms. Rhythms, there's rhythms again.
So, Lee, we've been talking about celebrating families and especially babies. So I have to mention something that I know that you'll probably be working on a little bit during the Christmas season, and that is promoting your new book, which is about to be released, called Infertile But Fruitful. And it's really a celebration of what it means to have a family and to form a family. And can you tell us a little bit about your book? I know we've talked about it on the show. We're going to keep talking about it because it's such a big deal and such a labor of love. So when does it come out? And can you talk a little bit, we have about a minute left, about your pre-publication press and responses you've been having?
Yeah, I've done a bit. Podcasts have been the main thing I've been doing, and people are really, it's getting some, you know, broader attention than I kind of thought. I think everyone either is or knows or loves someone that has been afflicted, even with just a season of infertility. So it piques people's interests. I think Christmas can be a really hard time of year when your arms are still empty again. And so I think that's maybe a good idea to maybe offer some prayers for those that are suffering infertility through the holidays,
that's
like
a
through
great
Christmas and New
idea.
Year's. Yeah, because it's just like sort of another reminder of, you know, another year without a child to love. Yeah, so the book comes out January 20th. I'll be doing some more. Our own Alyssa Murphy did a nice interview of me in the National Catholic Register. You can find that online. And I've got lots of other stuff planned. So if you're not too tired of hearing me talk about my book, maybe you'll like to buy it and read it for yourself.
I'm really excited about it. I think that it is just what we need, especially in this season, talking about the gift that children are. And, you know, sometimes they come in different forms. I mean, and we have to celebrate all the different ways that we come together as families, whether there are our biological children or our adoptive children. They're still our beloved children, just like we are God's beloved children.
Indeed. Amen.
Well, Lee, I will be toasting you on the new year and hoping that you have a blessed time with your family through this season. And, thank you so much for our chat about all things Christmas.
Yeah, thank you, Betsy.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences. I'm joined during this blessed Christmas season with Monsignor Roger Landry, our TCA chaplain. Monsignor Landry, what a beautiful time of year, and what a beautiful time for Christmas music and hymns.
It is, and Christmas hymns are just an extraordinary way for us to be able to pass on our faith that we should never underestimate. Most of us, when we were growing up, learned how to sing so many of these extraordinary Christmas hymns, which put into our imagination, into our vocal cords, into our hearts and our minds, before we could really even understand them, some of the most important truths that we're supposed to grasp and then pass on. One of my favorites, of course, is O Come All Ye Faithful, in which we sort of join with the shepherds and the magi and the angels and the animals going to Bethlehem in order to adore the Lord Jesus. We still are able to do that, of course, in the Holy Eucharist, but just how beautiful that hymn is and how inspiring it is. And every time we start on that G, I'm a musician and I can't help because I used to play it on the organ lots of times and I loved it. Every time we hit that G for the O, it just starts to bring back so many happy memories. But then we have Hark the Herald Angels Sing, which is just what a refrain. To be beaten only by angels we have heard on high, as we all start singing glory in all its notes to the O Holy Night. Minuit Chrétien, we used to call it in French, in the French parishes where I was pastor, that would be sung at midnight mass at midnight, that I used to always do when I was pastor. It really would send the thrill of hope all the way coursing through our bones and coursing through our muscles. O little town of Bethlehem, O silent night. It goes on and on and on. But these are wonderful ways. Christmas is a time where it's very easy for us to speak about our faith and share our faith. When we're able to wish people a blessed Christmas, when we're able to remember that the reason of the season is not just Jesus, the reason of the season is what Jesus wants to do in you and me and transform us, etc., that it's easy to talk about the faith, but when we go out Christmas caroling, you know, people want to hear that, and it's extraordinary. So, Betsy, putting you on the spot, what are your favorite Christmas hymns?
Well, I had a goosebumps as you were even saying the names of those hymns, and I really love Joy to the World, and I can't get through it without a tear in my eye, because I mean, I think the essence of our faith is joy. And I was thinking as you were saying all these, he who sings prays twice, and I thought that is really true during the Christmas season.
And like Saint Augustine actually didn't say exactly that.
Oh, tell
He
me.
said, quis cantat bene, bis orat. And so he said, the one who sings well sings twice. And but I get your point, because any one of us using the instrument that God has given us to sing, we're already singing well. We might not be singing as well as a professional singer, but that's the best we can be singing. So we're singing well. And that's when we're praying more. Why? Because we're putting way more of ourselves into it. It's like our faith is not just true, but our faith is beautiful. And we can convey the beauty so much better through music than we can just in prose or even in poetry. And so, because we've been made with the capacity and a note structure, right? We can speak with different notes. I can go low, I can go high at the same time. We're able to sing, and God made us that way so that we'd be able to speak the truth in ever more beautiful ways. And that's one of the things the angels did on Christmas morning, as they were singing, "Glory to God in the highest, and peace on earth to people of goodwill." That's one of the things for which God has made us. And that's what we hope to join in forever with the choirs of heaven, singing praise and thanks to God forevermore.
You know, I read that Peter Kreeft became a Catholic through sacred music, and that's really struck me because I'm a cradle Catholic. But the idea that, and I believe, you know, he grew up in another Christian denomination. But do you ever see that? Do you see the people coming to you and saying there's something about the Catholic Church, and maybe especially during Christmas time with all of our traditions?
Well, Pope Benedict XVI had once said that listening to Mozart's Mass in B minor was enough to convert somebody, just the beauty of it. I thought that that was a little bit of his German sensibility. I thought that it could convey the beauty of our faith and the solemnity and stuff. But that's kind of what happened in the life of Peter Kreeft, whom you just mentioned. Peter was a Calvinist, and the Calvinists grew up singing the typical sort of Protestant Presbyterian hymns. But then he listened to a Bach Mass. Well, he got to Fordham and he started to listen to some of the most extraordinary pieces in the church's repertoire. And he knew through the beauty that this was true, that God was true, and that the church that would preserve this and use it liturgically, use it not for a concert, but use it in our very worship to the Lord, that was a real proof of its authenticity. There were, of course, with a mind like Peter Kreeft, lots of logical reasons at the same time too, but he received the strength that he needed to become a Catholic through the conviction by beauty that came to him through his emotions. And so that's just such an extraordinary thing in his own life. But music does have the capacity to remind people that they have a soul. And once they realize that they have a soul, it opens them up to a soul in dialogue with God, to a real search for the truth, a real search for goodness, a search for beauty. And that's when the Catholic faith is on home turf.
It must be really a special, unique feeling that you have as a celebrant to hear a whole church on Christmas just bursting with joy and song.
All of the people singing the organ at full volume, even a celebrant. I love to sing those masses to be able to bring even greater beauty to the truths of our faith. There's nothing like celebrating Mass on Christmas.
Monsignor, thank you so much for joining us, and Merry Christmas to you. And we can't wait to talk about the Advent. I mean, can't wait to talk about the rest of the Christmas season because it still goes on for a while next week. Thank you
A
so much.
joyous and blessed 12 days of Christmas to you as well, Betsy.